like a knife. Yeah, but it feels so right. When we went in the studio, I had written songs around the idea of playing them live. And so what you have on Cuts Like a Knife is a record of songs which are very accessible live. And we went out and did the right after that record, and we toured again on a bunch of songs that were fun to play live. It was fun. This time, everything is all right. Go away, she's gonna get away. This time, everything is easy. Any day, I'm gonna make her mine. Out to take me back. Hello, this is Brian Adams of Cuts Like a Knife in the studio.
I must agree with writer Ed Rivadavia in the AllMusic Guide, and I quote, "After the indifference which met his first album, Brian Adams reportedly considered naming his sophomore release, Brian Adams Hasn't Heard of You Either." Adams would finally achieve chart-topping perfection on his next release, Reckless, but Cuts Like a Knife comes pretty close, end quote. If you wanted to write a rock and roll fairy tale, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better inspiration than the story of Brian Adams. He was only 16 years old, a straw-haired kid from Vancouver, British Columbia, when he started knocking on record company doors, trying to convince people to listen to his songs. He was still only 19 when he signed a record deal, only 20 when his first album came out in 1979. He went on, of course, to become one of the biggest stars of the 80s and 90s, selling millions of records, writing songs for and doing duets with the likes of Rod Stewart and Tina Turner, headlining sold-out shows around the world. But the album that started it all, Brian Adams' first platinum album, was Cuts Like a Knife, released in early 1983. It contained his first top 10 single, Straight from the Heart, and it paved the way for the incredible success of his 1984 album, Reckless. From then on, there was no disputing that Brian Adams had become Canada's biggest rock and roll star. It was a pretty fast climb for somebody so young, but Brian Adams says age is something he never worried about.
I was 15 when I started writing songs, but none of them were really of any importance. They were just fragments and ideas which I assembled on cassettes. And when I was 18, I wrote Straight from the Heart, and that song did pretty good. There were some songs for a band called Prism, which I'd written at that time too, which had done fairly well in Canada. And then we started moving on. And 19 and 20, I wrote my first album. And 20 and 21, I wrote the second album, and so on and so forth, you know. I don't think age is really relevant. I think it's all a question of maturity and awareness and drive. And of course, most importantly, talent. I mean, the things that drive you, I mean, are the things that will carry you on throughout your life. And I certainly was always very musical and liked music. And I felt early on that I would have some sort of career in it, but I didn't know it would ever lead as far as it has. I just liked it. I just liked music. It just seemed to be a nice thing to do. And it sure beat working.
Yeah.
from Cuts Like a Knife. That's Bryan Adams with the number 15 hit single, This Time. Sitting at Bryan's kitchen table in Vancouver, I wondered what his first memories of music were.
Oh, I know exactly what the earliest recollection of music is in my family, and that is my father playing opera at Warp 10 in the living room. And it was just something that we were brought up with. We were brought up with loud classical music. My earliest recollection of music before really acknowledging opera as opera was probably things like the Black Watch, which is Highland Scottish music. It's marching music from the Black Watch is a regiment of Scottish soldiers, and that's probably my earliest recollection of music. Yeah, my parents liked that.
Bryan Adams' parents were born in England, but they emigrated to Canada in the 1950s. His father was a career diplomat, working first for the Canadian military, later for the United Nations. Bryan's mother was a librarian. Bryan was born in Ontario, but his formative years were spent in a number of places, in Portugal, in England, in Israel, and in Austria. Bryan Adams was 14 when the family settled in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Traveling as a child, probably maybe more accustomed to traveling as an adult. I mean, my whole life has been one big journey, so I think that maybe my early days of traveling sort of set me straight for what I was going to do in the future. There are definite advantages to of having a very traveled youth, and that was that, you know, you have some experiences of other cultures, you have experiences of meeting other new people all the time, changing friends all the time, and it's tough when you're a kid, but I mean, having all those experiences makes you, I think, more aware. And I mean, certainly when I came back from Europe, I used to go to American and British schools, I was a year ahead of everybody else when I got back to Canada. And so I had to adjust again to a whole different thing. For the first 6 years of going to school, I had to wear a tie and a uniform. And so, when we came back to Canada, it was so strange having to just wear whatever you wanted.
Even with all that moving around, there was one constant in Bryan Adams' life, his love of music. Originally, Bryan wanted to be a drummer, but his parents wouldn't allow drums in the house. Then he asked for a piano, but they said that was too expensive. Finally, they gave in and bought Bryan a guitar.
When I first started playing guitar, I was about 10. My father bought me a classical guitar, which I didn't really like because it wasn't electric. I wanted an electric guitar, and I sort of played with it a little bit. And when I was 12, I bought an electric guitar, and that's when I took it more seriously. But at any rate, I'd saved up enough money before I went back to Israel to buy a guitar. And on the way through England, we went to England for some time, and I bought a guitar there. And then music in England, there's so much going on at that point. There was the Beatles, and there was Stones, and everything was happening. And so it just seemed like the right thing to do. Of course, my father hated the idea of me becoming a musician. And so there was a real sort of tension between who was going to get the stereo that night.
By the time he was in high school, Bryan Adams was back in Canada, and that was where he put together his first rock and roll band.
Everybody goes through that garage band thing where you get your guitar, and then you want to find a bunch of guys that play drums and bass, and then you sort of assemble a band. And we used to play in backyards. I did a whole circuit of club gigs and small concerts and stuff with my bands, and I did a whole bunch of club things by the time I was 16. And I wasn't even old enough to play in some of these places, but they put me in the back and gave me a Coke. It was interesting, but I didn't like the club scene that much, and I felt that doing covers or whatever it was you were going to do was nowhere unless you wrote your own music. You had to write your own music, otherwise you were going to fall back in with everybody else, and there would be no future for you. Because by looking at records and stuff, I realized that everybody that was a major artist was writing their own stuff. So there had to be something to that. So sit down and write, Adams. And so I spent some time doing that, and nothing really came of it, of course, because you're too young to know really what you're doing.
When we got started, but lately I have found
That's Don't Leave Me Lonely from Bryan Adams' 1983 album Cuts Like a Knife. Bryan met Jim Vallance, a Vancouver songwriter who was part of a moderately successful Canadian rock band called Prism. Vallance was several years older than Bryan and had already written songs for bands like Bachman Turner Overdrive and Kiss. It was the beginning of a truly remarkable songwriting partnership.
I met Jim in a music store when I was 18. He was talking to some girl that was a piano player, which I knew. I walked over to talk to her for a second, and she goes, "Oh, by the way, this is my friend Jim. Jim's a songwriter." And I said, "Oh, yeah. What's your last name?" And he goes, "Jim Vallance." I said, "Oh, wow, I've heard of you." And he goes, "Oh, well, I've heard of you, too." And so we both sort of had heard of each other because at that time, I was looking to try and get some studio work. I wanted to break into doing some singing and sing on people's demos or whatever it is you do to learn to become a singer, and in the studio. And Jim and I just met, and I said, "Well, you know, we should get together sometime." And he said, "Well, let's get together tomorrow and have a cup of tea." And so we did that, and we got together and started writing songs, just like that. I mean, the same day we got together, we wrote songs. And it wasn't really until I met Jim Vallance that I assembled songs in the correct way, because I used to, you know, have a verse and a chorus and then a guitar solo that went on for, you know, 2 minutes, and then back to a chorus, and then a bridge. You know, there was no semblance to any of the songs. So I think that's probably what was great about Jim. He gave me a lot of focus.
It was clear that their musical instincts were made for each other. The next step was deciding where to go with their songs. Should they sell them to other singers, form a band together, or should they let Bryan be the frontman while Vallance stayed in the background?
There came a point in time where we'd put together enough songs that either do something with your own career or else give the songs away or something. We'd assembled about 5 or 6 songs, and with no real purpose, here we are. What are we going to do now? Is it going to be Adams and Vallance, the band, or is it going to be me, what is it going to be? So we, at that point, decided to send some tapes out to record companies and find some interest, which we did find with A&M Records. And I signed at 19 to A&M. We released my first album when I was 20, because I went in the studio right away and started recording the first album. That's the rest of sort of history.
I'd like to see you, but I let you know. I wanna be with you every day. Let me hear.
great song. That's called I'm Ready, one of the first songs that Jim Vallance and Bryan Adams wrote together. That comes from Cuts Like a Knife. When we come back, we'll hear how Bryan was allowed to produce his first album, even though he was still a teenager. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for 1983's Cuts Like a Knife.
Hello, this is Bryan Adams at Cuts Like a Knife in the studio.
Thanks, Bryan. I'm Redbeard. Even as early as his second album, 1982's You Want It, You Got It, Bryan Adams has been a prolific songwriter of hit songs, making it seem effortless and his bankability appear obvious. Yet Bryan assures us that getting a record company to sign him was hard.
I mean, it was very difficult getting a record deal. You know, first of all, the biggest question was, well, do you have a band? And it was, no. Well, do you have a manager? No. What do you have other than these demos? And it's like, nothing. They got me. And it's like, I can understand now why people are frustrated when, you know, they try and get tapes through. And the whole thing about getting a record deal was a difficult process. And anyone that's tried to do that will sympathize that, you know, it's one thing to write songs, but it's another thing to try and get yourself signed on a record company. But anyway, luckily, I followed my hunches and went with A&M. I went with them for a reason. That was, I liked a lot of the things they were doing at the time, the Supertramp and Gino Vannelli, and I thought it was a classy label. There was something about it that I liked, and they had a lot of faith in me at the beginning because they let me produce my own records. I was 19, I had no studio experience, and to let me go in the studio and do that was really, really special, and I really have to be very thankful to them for that, because nowadays things are so different that there's always somebody wanting to put their hands in as a producer. Everyone's a producer, aren't they? So we experimented, and the first album is very much like a demo. It's very much like us experimenting to try and find some sort of sound that was going to make a record. And we immediately went into the second album with a totally different approach, and that was we'd taken a lot of the songs that we'd written after the first album and tried them on the road. There was a different flavor suddenly, because some of the songs that were recorded on the first album didn't work live. And so I didn't want that to happen again. I wanted to test everything before I went in the studio again. And the second album was You Want It, You Got It. And Lonely Nights came out of that. One of my favorite songs, Tonight, came out of that. And all those songs were just road tested, and it worked.
just catched in another lonely night. So come over and save me. Baby, I just can't stand it. Another lonely, another lonely night. Yeah.
Although at the time Bryan Adams had not spent many years in the music business, you couldn't say he hadn't paid his dues by the time of Cuts Like a Knife's 1983 release, spending hours in rehearsal, writing songs, and endless months on the road touring.
I can tell you about Take Me Back. There was always, when you're doing some gigs and you're not exactly the headliner, there's always a moment of in the audience where they're thinking, oh, who is this guy up there? I mean, if you haven't got a hit song, especially, it's very difficult to go out and play with other bands. But we had one secret weapon, and that was Take Me Back. It was a song that started out as a joke live. We did it because it was actually a song of Jim's, which I embellished on it. We had a lot of fun with that song live and eventually turned it into something. Then there was an extended rap, which I used to do in the middle of the song about whatever came to mind that evening, but most of it was quite profane. And it was always a good crowd pleaser, and so that song sort of evolved as sort of a good time song that was always, it was a very good audience participation song.
Yeah.
she need me? Well, I must have been blind. She didn't give me a warning. She says, I shouldn't treat you wrong. When I woke up this morning, she was gone.
The whole advent of songwriting and touring and finally came to a final focus when we went to the studio for Cuts Like a Knife, because I had done so many gigs at that point. I had toured so much on What You Want It, You Got It, playing and supporting and whatever else. I mean, I would have done weddings if it took, you know. But there was a real focus in my mind as to, you know, what I wanted to sound like. So when we went in the studio, I had written songs around the idea of playing them live. And so what you have on Cuts Like a Knife is a record of songs which are very accessible live. And we went out and did the right after that record, and we toured again on a bunch of songs that were fun to play live. It was fun, you know. It was just these songs worked, and people liked them, and it was a good time. That's really all it was.
I could start dreaming, but it never ends. As long as you're gone, we may as well pretend. I've been dreaming straight from the heart. You say it's easy, but who's to say that we'd be able to keep it?
Bryan Adams' 1983 album Cuts Like a Knife, that's Bryan's first top 10 hit, Straight from the Heart. Next, Bryan discusses the breakthrough title song and takes a song from the album which he wrote at the age of 18 and completely reinvents it. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Bryan Adams for Cuts Like a Knife.
Hello, this is Bryan Adams at Cuts Like a Knife in the studio.
Thanks again, Bryan. I'm Redbeard. Bryan told me that when he would write songs with his partner back then, Jim Vallance, they would compose the music with a tape recorder running while Bryan would hum melody lines. Then they'd go back and listen to the tape and, quote, sort out my mumbles for lyric ideas, according to Bryan Adams.
Because I had some focus at that point, I went on to make Cuts Like a Knife. Again, we didn't realize what we were doing writing-wise. Writing-wise, it's always an experiment, you know. There's never really any sort of immediate focus until we sit down and start going, well, what should we do on this record? And it's like, well, let's try and write a song like this. And we set up a beat and a groove, and away we go. But I remember one of the first things we wrote for Cuts Like a Knife was the title track. And that simply came out through a mumble. I was simply playing a guitar to a groove, and I mumbled Cuts Like a Knife, and Jim stopped the tape and said, well, let's listen to that. And we went back and listened, and we started working on it, and next thing you know, it became the chorus, and Jim added, it feels so right, and, you know, the song was created. And I had to go and do a couple of gigs, and I went down to Seattle, and we played the Paramount Theater in Seattle, and that was the first time I ever played that song live. And I just remember the band sort of connecting suddenly, and the audience responding, and I thought, wow, this is going to be a good song.
Misunderstood. Ooh, yeah. So wait a-
It's like a knife. Yeah, when I feel so
title song to Bryan Adams' 1983 breakthrough album, Cuts Like a Knife. There was another factor in the success of the album, a new component back then in the music business.
At that time when Cuts Like a Knife was coming out, MTV was really kicking in pretty heavily at that time. It was very early days for them as well, 83. I mean, they think they came out in 81 or something. So Cuts Like a Knife was suddenly put into what they called sort of maximum rotation at their TV station, and that was neat too, because I never had a video that done anything. So the whole idea of videos, initially when an artist was asked to do a video in the early 80s and late 70s, it was because the people in Europe would like to see what you look like. There was no way of promoting you otherwise, any other way, because you'd show it on TV or something if you had a hit song. But the idea of a music channel 24 hours was really, really exciting. And I remember that seeing the video on there. I mean, it's really difficult to say anything other than it was just a great moment. You know, that whole year was an extended tour, you know. I don't remember seeing home very much that year, but we played a lot of concerts. We went over to Europe for the first set of dates too. And the album did really well. Really well. Stopped me worrying about paying the rent and the phone bill.
Just a small town girl in the city lights. The best was yet to come. Then lonely days turn to endless nights. The best was yet to come. How were you to know that you would be the lucky one? Ain't it funny how time flies when the best is yet to come? You can cry yourself to sleep at night. You can't change the things you've done. You had it there, then it slipped away. Yeah, you left the song unsung. Even through your tears, I never saw. So good about goodbye, when the best was yet to come. I find myself thinking about yesterday, when you were here and living in a dream. In the moment that it takes, you find you made your first mistake. Like the setting sun, you turn around, it's gone. Just a small town girl who had it made, or so the story goes. She had it there, then it slipped away. Oh,
goodbye, goodbye, when the best was yet to come.
One of the most puzzling aspects of the music world over the last 35 years has been the fickle cannibalization of the most successful stars by certain gatekeepers in the media, such as music critics and radio programmers. Superstar rockers Elton John and Rod Stewart in the 1970s, Billy Joel and Sting in the 80s, and Bryan Adams in the 90s, they all scored international superstardom with a ballad, only to be dismissed by certain self-appointed arbiters of rock and roll for somehow losing credibility in the process. Here is Bryan Adams.
Well, I don't really know about credibility. I just know about music, and this is about music. And so when someone calls me up and says, hey, you know, you fancy coming out and singing, you know, it could be Tina Turner, or it could be Bonnie Raitt, or it could be Barbara Streisand, or it could be, I don't know, if it seems like something that would be musically challenging, I'm normally quite interested in it. And, you know, I've had some pretty high moments in my life singing with people. And, you know, one of my highest moments was singing with Smokey Robinson at the Apollo Theater back a few years ago. It wasn't a record, but it was a TV show. And I suppose, you know, if you can walk into a world that is unfamiliar and make it seem like your own for a moment, then I think you've accomplished something. And I'm into this for music. I'm not sure about, I don't know, it's a fickle world about whether you're credible or not. And at the end of the day, if you feel comfortable making music because it's what inspires you, then that's what you should do. It's not about trying to garner up an image. It's about making music. I mean, I did this thing a few years ago, which was madness. I went and sang with an opera singer called Luciano Pavarotti. Mm-hmm. And he has this show every year. I mean, Eric Clapton was on it last year, and U2 was on it before that. And, you know, I stepped on stage and sang in Italian on live television. But it's only because I was challenged by the idea of it. And life is about creating yourself little challenges. Otherwise, things can get kind of dull. And I brought my dad along with me, and we had a fantastic time in Italy. And we sang, and we ate great pasta, and we had a great time. And it's one of the most memorable moments of my life. But it's, again, the reason what was great about it was it was music. It was about making music.
By the time of Bryan Adams' 1997 MTV Unplugged performance, many of rock's biggest stars had already appeared over the preceding decade. Yet Bryan Adams' MTV Unplugged show was actually one of the most memorable.
We had already put out a greatest hits record, but I didn't want to repeat that again. And with most of my records, I don't want to repeat myself. So stylistically, I wanted to make it different. And perhaps even to push the MTV boundary a bit and bring in musicians and arrangements that perhaps you wouldn't ordinarily hear on MTV. It was a chance really to sort of reinvent things and to really hang your, well, I can't really say it, but, you know, to hang yourself out in the line. You know, there's a song like on the album called I'm Ready, which I wrote when I was 18. And that song was recorded on Cuts Like a Knife. It was recorded a few years after I wrote it, and we reinvented that quite severely for this record. And I'm actually very proud of that arrangement. I think it's a real jewel on the album.
It's one of my favorite rockers that you did originally, but it gets totally transformed.
Yeah, it gets completely transformed, and it's got a Celtic sort of vibe, and it's really quite. It's got a lonesome sound to it now, which I like. But see, that song never got a chance before. I mean, people, you know, like yourself might have played it, but it never got heard. And so what this Unplugged allows you to do is to take a chance and reinvent it. And that's exactly what we did. We reinvented it.
I'd like to see you, thought I'd let you know. I wanna be with you every day. Cause I got a feeling it's beginning to grow.
There's only one thing I can say. I'm ready to love you. I'm ready to hold you. I'm ready to love you. I'm ready to hold you. I'm ready as I'm gonna be. To find, but baby, it's easy, and I'll make it clear. There's only one thing on my mind. I'm ready to love you. I'm ready to hold you.
Absolutely stunning, with the Irish pipes of Davy Spillane and the sweeping orchestral arrangement of the late maestro Michael Kamen. You need to see and hear this by Brian Adams on the DVD filmed outdoors at Slane Castle in Ireland in 2000. Spectacular. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the Studio, thanking my dear friend Brian Adams. You can visit inthestudio.net for this and your other favorite interviews. In the Studio was written this edition by yours truly, Redbeard, and by Joe Rhodes. Transcription by Jane Carpenter. Theme song by Andy Timmons. In the Studio, produced by Barbarossa Limited, copyright 2008, all rights reserved. Be a part of the In the Studio Network at inthestudio.net.